Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
It is time for Dear Science. Thank you, MOTAT. And I'm joined in studio by Alan Blackman. How are you, Alan?
I am very well, Lillian.
Good. We've also got Trixie in studio, who's not anywhere near a microphone, so you can just shout out, hey, Trixie. No. Okay. Don't know if we can hear that, but that's Trixie's hanging out with us today again. First up, though, Blackman, Mr. Black, what was I saying? I was going black holes.
Brilliant.
First up, black holes, but also Alan Blackman. Okay, anyway, we are talking about black holes.
We are.
We've got the first photo of a black hole.
Yes.
Now, can you just, I mean, this is a huge deal,
this
right?
is a very, very big deal, yes. So in order to figure out just how big a deal it is, we probably need to delve back and talk about what black holes are and where they come
let's do
from
that.
And everything. So let's do the old historical thing. So they come all the way from good old Albert Einstein way back in the early 1900s with his theory of relativity, the theory of general relativity. And basically, what are black holes? They are things that are so massive, that have such incredible density, that have such incredibly strong gravitational pull, that nothing can get away from them, not even light. So light gets affected by gravity, which does seem kind of weird.
I just still find that buzzy. But.
Well, again, you know, that was first predicted by Einstein as well, the fact that very, very massive objects warp space-time, if you want a better explanation than that. And so because they warp space-time, that means that light then doesn't travel in straight lines. So when it gets near to a massive body, it will travel in curves. And all beyond our level of comprehension. I'm pretty sure about that. And especially this whole thing about black holes. So what happens with black holes, the way that they are thought to be formed, is that a star nears the end of its life, and stars run on this thing called nuclear fusion. So they take basically hydrogen, they convert it to helium, and then they convert it to beryllium, et cetera, heavier and heavier and heavier elements. So this process called nuclear fusion requires extraordinarily high temperatures, extraordinarily high pressures. You've got to push these nuclei together, get them to fuse, and then eventually you get all the way up to iron, which is element number 26 of the 118 on the periodic table. And once you get there, then the temperatures and the pressures inside a star are insufficient to get that to fuse with anything else. So basically, all of your matter inside your star gets turned to iron. And iron is a lot denser than your hydrogen, your helium, and all your starting materials. And so the inside of the star gets very, 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 very dense. And then what then happens once the hydrogen and all of those elements start running out is that the star eventually collapses under its own gravitational pull.
Right.
Because now it's got all this really, really dense stuff at its core. That's exerting a huge gravitational pull. And so the whole thing collapses. And that is, depending on the mass of the star, that can form a thing called a white dwarf. Or it can go the whole hog, and if the star is particularly massive, it can form a black hole. And this black hole then is so ridiculously dense that nothing can escape from it, and it actively goes swallowing up more and more and more matter because of its incredible gravitational forces.
This must be happening fairly often.
Yep.
So there are a lot of black holes.
Yeah, the current thinking is that that black holes are at the centre of every galaxy. And so that's why they rotate around their center, because you've got these ultra massive things in the middle. That's kind of the theory anyway.
Okay.
But the fact that obviously no light can escape from these things is going to make it difficult to see them.
Yes.
Before
we get there, though, I just want to say, wouldn't that be that if they actively go and suck things up, essentially?
Yep.
Eventually there'll be nothing left. Is that a thing? Do black holes join up with other black holes and become bigger black holes?
Very probably, but that's probably one for the cosmologists,
okay.
I think.
All
right. But I think you're probably right in that. Yeah.
Back to the photo. I mean, I'm just saying it's a great film idea, right? Back to the photo. How do we get a photo?
Well, how do we get a photo? Well, not easily, number one, because these guys are, in terms of size, they're very, very small, as you might expect, because they're highly, highly, highly dense. And so with anything that's really, really, really small, you're going to need a telescope of extraordinarily high resolution to be able to see that. And so we've got this wonderful Hubble Space Telescope up there and everything, but that's not sufficient in this case. Okay. So what they had to do, and this was all done, in fact, 2 years ago. So it's taken them 2 years since actually obtaining the data for this photo to actually deconvolute the photo and release it. So all these data came in 2017.
Whoa.
Oh, yes, indeed. And that took an awful lot of planning. And basically, they had eight radio telescopes all situated all around the world, one actually at the South Pole. Yes.
Okay.
And what they needed to do was to take the data sort of March, April, because that's when the weather's the best for all of these places. They had to have obviously clear skies, et cetera, et cetera. It couldn't be raining because rain interferes with, or moisture in the atmosphere interferes with the signals and stuff like that. So the reason that they could do it with these eight radio telescopes all around the world is that the resolution, what they've basically done is turned the Earth into a radio telescope. The whole Earth became a collector, let's say, for all of the radiation coming from this black hole. Okay, so you had these eight individual spots all over the Earth. They were all collecting the data at different points, and they were analysing by a thing called interferometry, which, as the name suggests, the waves sort of interfere with each other, and so at each different point on the planet, the waves will have interfered with each other just a tiny little bit differently, okay? And so the guts of it is that what they ended up collecting, and this is truly astonishing, was half a ton of hard disks worth of data. Half a ton.
What? I mean, the undertaking of gathering the data sounded massive.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So they needed all of these things to be done, you know, absolutely synchronized, etc., etc. They needed the weather to be good. They got that, so they all pointed the telescopes at this one place, you know, and the size of this thing. So it's the equivalent of seeing an orange on the moon, apparently.
Wow, that's tiny.
So you can imagine the resolution needed to get this was, you know,
fairly good,
quite extraordinary.
Okay, so in terms of having all of this data or information,
yep.
Then what did they have to do with it?
Then they had to deconvolute it. Okay, because it's not like it's a, you know, it's an actual picture.
No.
So they had to take into account, you know, that they were collecting it all over the world and everything, and basically sort of stitch all the data together, for want of a better term, to make that final image. And that they could do this was thanks to a PhD student, for goodness sake, by the name of Katie Bauman, who is a PhD student at MIT. And she was the one who made the algorithm that enabled them to basically deconvolute the data, which...
Go Katie.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, wow.
Yeah, wow indeed.
No pressure either. So does she get some kudos for this?
Well, she's sort of well-known around the world now. Yep, so she's being interviewed all over the show and everything. Yeah. And you know, she's definitely getting kudos out of this. And it's quite an astonishing achievement to be able to have done this. And I'm sure all the listeners will have actually seen the picture.
This, I mean, you might laugh when you hear where I'm going with this, but this is technically, like you say, not an actual picture of something. So are
no.
we actually seeing the black hole? Did we actually
get
a photo
because,
of the moon?
Because you can't see the black hole, because so the light that you see around it is the light that is essentially the matter that's surrounding the black hole.
Okay.
Okay, a thing apparently called the accretion disk.
So that's what we're seeing.
So that's what you're seeing, and the black bit at the centre of it is the actual black hole.
Okay.
Okay.
But again, it's not necessarily an actual photograph of the thing.
No, well, they were using radio telescopes to start off with, so they're not looking at visible light, so, you know, they have to sort of deconvolute all that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, no, it's not like pointing a camera at it and taking click photo, okay?
But we are seeing something.
We are definitely seeing something, yeah.
Amazing.
And, this is just quite astonishing stuff.
Can we just, I mean, while we're on this, let's touch on the New Zealander who's the long time theory is involved in this.
And this is a Kiwi who should be way better known than he is. So his name's Roy Kerr. And he was born in Kurau. And I was thinking, oh gosh, that's the second famous New Zealander to be born in Kurau after Richie McCaw. But Richie McCaw was apparently born in Oamaru.
Okay.
according to Wikipedia. So
I don't know these things.
But, okay, so he was a maths whiz from an early age, mm-hmm. and apparently he went straight from school to third year mathematics at Canterbury University. Come on, give me a wow. Out of school to third year maths. And then went and did a PhD in Cambridge and then went to the States where he went to Syracuse. He postdoced at Syracuse, ended up at Texas.
I'm still on the – are you allowed to do that, just skip your papers?
Well, if you're that good, yes. Okay. Yeah. And so it was while he was at the University of Texas he was interested in the theory of relativity, and Einstein had left some equations about what should happen to very, very, very dense matter and what's going to happen with that. And in fact, the term black hole hadn't been coined by the time that Roy Kerr started his work on these things. So that was only that term only came to being in 1967. Hmm. And so he was doing this work in about 1962, and he managed to solve these ridiculously complicated Einstein field equations by hand, no computers or anything like that. And basically, the guts of it was that black holes should rotate. That's sort of the guts of all this. And it was a fabulous, fabulous mathematical / physics achievement, actually doing this and confirming that Einstein's prediction, essentially, that these black holes should rotate. He found the only possible solution, and then they started looking for black holes. Black holes weren't known at that stage, okay? So black holes only sort of came into sort of being sort of in the last, you know, sort of 30, 40 years. Before that, they were the thing of science fiction, essentially.
Yeah, okay. You know? I mean, they were there and they were happening.
They were certainly there, but nobody...
But we weren't able to figure out what was going on.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, thanks to this, world-leading Kiwi, they were able to figure out the maths of black holes. And,
brilliant.
You know, and for his work, he was awarded the Einstein Medal, the Albert Einstein Medal, which is kind of cool. He's the only New Zealander to win that. And he's also won the Rutherford Medal, which is New Zealand's highest honour for science.
Wow.
So, a great man. Maybe give him a knighthood or something like that. Maybe, you know, might be a good idea.
Yeah, something like that is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I reckon. So a little old New Zealand, you know, we do make a splash.
There you go.
I say we, I mean he. But, you know, the whole country takes credit for it. You know how
they
it
often
is.
Do, yeah. Yes. I know, I mean, this is a massive topic and I'm sure that we'll keep talking about it.
Indeed.
Do you want to say anything else before we move on? Lots of people are excited about this. This is why I want to.
Oh, there's some nice cartoons out there or something. You know that apparently it's out of focus. People are very upset that the whole thing's out of focus. You know, it looks a bit blurry, and then they sharpen it up, and it looks like a cat's eye and all that sort of stuff. So, but fabulous stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll see, I guess, where this goes in terms of awards and stuff like that. Whether it's Nobel worthy, I don't know, because there'll be so many people involved in this. It's going to be impossible to narrow it down to three.
True.
I'd say. So, yeah.
Let's quickly touch on the causes of cancer possibly being in our DNA.
Indeed. So you recall that we spoke, God, was it last year?
Possibly.
About the guy in the States that got awarded about $200 million for getting cancer from Roundup.
Or yes, I remember this.
Purportedly getting cancer from Roundup, okay? And I sort of made the point that it's very difficult to know the exact cause of cancer, to actually prove that cancer is caused by whatever. So there's some workers in Britain have very, very recently published, in fact this week, their research into particular chemicals and particular processes that are thought to be involved in cancer. Oh, and causing cancer, certainly. So basically what they did was they took some human stem cells, and those are cells that haven't figured out what they want to be yet. And so they exposed these stem cells to 79 different chemicals and processes that were thought to be involved in causing cancer. So,
for example?
Things like solar radiation, for example, so UV irradiation. Chemotherapy drugs, of all things, so they actually cause cancer.
Okay.
That's why they can actually cure cancer, because they can cause cancer. And chemicals in tobacco smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did that. They exposed these cells to those things, and then they analysed them afterwards. And they found that 52% of all of the agents produced genetic changes that could be observed in cells. Okay, so
say that again.
So 52% of these chemicals or processes gave you mutations in DNA that you could actually
observe. They specifically, those things caused the mutation,
and they caused specific mutations. That's the thing
that were cancerous or could become. Or,
so they compared these with actual known cancers. So like things like lung cancers that were known to be caused by smoking,
tobacco,
chemotherapy drugs and stuff like that. And they compared them and they found that the mutations looked to be very, very similar / the same.
Right. So this is essentially something that we do know, though. These things do cause cancer.
But they do cause cancer.
But the study shows that we can specifically map it happening.
Yes, they can show that cancer was caused by that particular chemical or that particular process or whatever. Okay, and so this potentially is a very, very big deal.
Yes.
Which is tempered by the fact that only 52%. So it's you get a 1 in 2 chance.
Right, okay.
Of these things leaving some sort of telltale trail in your DNA. But, and the authors were very, very careful to point out that, yes, they could see uses for this in the American legal system, obviously, where in cases like that Roundup one, you might actually be able to get an answer as to whether Roundup caused the cancer or not. So
is Round who's the company? They're gonna
Monsanto.
Will they go and appeal this? They did appeal it, right?
No, Monsanto / Bayer. I think Bayer bought Monsanto, but yes, they did appeal it, and the judgment was taken down to $80 million, they are still appealing as well. So this is going to go on for years and years and years. I mean, the poor guy's going to be dead by the time
will be
this.
Dead,
yeah.
But will they probably use this sort of study or look at it in this way now that...
Well, the thing is that their studies, haven't shown that Roundup causes cancer. Okay, so that's the thing. You know, you do need to take that with a grain of salt because it's their studies. They do have kind of a vested interest in this.
They do.
So what you need is, you know, somebody who is well away from the company doing these sorts of studies and, you know, being able to show yay or nay that this is what happens. But... That may or may not be the case, but as with all things medical, often these things are a matter of chance. You know, sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't, and so that has to be factored into everything as well. But I think it's an interesting piece of work, and it bodes well for the future of these sorts of things. If we can figure out, you know, what actually causes the cancer, then you know you can take steps
to prevent
those things. Yeah, of course.
Brilliant. Yeah. Thank you so much, Alan.
Not a problem.
Great to
always
have
a pleasure.
You win.
Thank you.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.